Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In February, President Obama announced that the U.S. government is planning to spend $3.6 trillion in 2013. Those are your tax dollars. Now, we often talk about the federal budget like we understand the process. But let's face it, most citizens have no idea how it actually works. Do you? Many forces shape the federal budget, including laws and special interests, and many people feel that the federal budget does not reflect their values and that the process is just too complex to understand. The National Priorities Project believes that in order to shift priorities, we need to understand how the process works. In the new book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget, the project's Mattia Kramer covers everything from the history of the federal budget and the main decision makers to where the money goes and where it comes from. Mattia Kramer is a senior research analyst with the National Priorities Project. That's a nonprofit that aims to make the federal budget transparent and accessible. She co-wrote A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. She also co-hosts weekly two-minute budget brief videos on YouTube. And Mattia joins us from her office in D.C. Hi, Mattia. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So I really enjoyed this book. It's full of graphics and cartoons. It's very easy to understand. Talk a little bit about the main goal in writing this book.
Sure. We as individuals face challenges like unaffordable health care or streetlights going out in our towns. But, you know, we don't always connect those challenges to problems that we face as a nation. But they are connected. And they're connected in something that's been, up until now, a subject that's the privilege of a select few. And that's how Washington spends our tax dollars.
And it's interesting because Barbara Ehrenreich, the author of Nickel and Dimed, wrote the foreword to the book, and she writes, "I understand now that differences in federal programs have a profound impact on individual lives. For example, anyone who is eligible for the food stamp program and applies for assistance will receive food stamp benefits. And as it turns out, that's because funding for that program is part of mandatory spending in the federal budget." And we'll talk about mandatory versus discretionary spending in the show. But do you think people realize just how the federal budget affects their lives? What do the studies tell us?
Oh, people do not at this point realize how the federal budget affects them. There are very interesting studies asking folks to talk about if and how they depend on federal programs. And these studies show that most of us don't recognize federal programs or federal spending even when we directly benefit from it. And that goes from Social Security checks to the highways we drive on or the clean water that we drink every day.
And how do you explain this confusion?
Well, I would say that our elected officials don't do a great job of communicating with us what it is that they're up to in Washington. So we don't know where our tax dollars are going, either for things that we support or things that we truly do not support.
So when you did this research, when you're talking about the federal budget, how are you able to make this palatable? What are some of the main points that you want people to take away with? What do we need to know about how it works?
Well, for starters, you and me, regular taxpayers, we fund the federal government. It's our income taxes and our payroll taxes that make up more than 80% of all federal tax revenue. So you and I, we own the government.
So more than 80%.
That's right, from regular people like us.
And where does the rest come from?
The rest comes from corporate income taxes and then little pots of money like excise taxes or customs duties. But those are relatively small shares as compared to the taxes that you and I pay.
And that's interesting because we talk so much about the federal budget, but I rarely hear that 80%, that 80% comes from individuals.
That's right, from regular people.
And so talk a little bit about the budget. President Obama back in February announced that the government is planning to spend $3.67 trillion in 2013.
Yeah, and more than 70% of that goes to some big ticket items, and that's health care, Social Security, the military, plus interest on the federal debt. So the vast majority of the federal budget goes to those programs, which by and large tend to be pretty popular among voters. And then the balance funds much smaller programs like education and highways and things like that.
And it's amazing to look at the pie chart to find out just what percentage goes, for example, to the military, to transportation, to veterans benefits, education, health care. And it's important to really talk about the differences between mandatory spending and discretionary spending.
Yeah, so that's a point that Barbara Ehrenreich made in her foreword, and it's a really important one. So what she was saying is that folks will be guaranteed food stamp benefits because it's part of mandatory spending, which means that anybody who's qualified for a program that's in mandatory spending will necessarily receive benefits. And so it's a guaranteed safety net mechanism. But there are many other programs that we think of as safety net mechanisms, such as our welfare program, which is officially known as Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. That's part of discretionary spending, and so that means that many folks who are eligible for the program won't ultimately receive benefits.
So discretionary spending typically represents about one-third of the total federal budget.
That's right.
And this is the portion that President Obama requests and then Congress appropriates every year.
That's right. It's only that third of the budget that actually goes through the appropriations process that we hear so much about in the news.
Okay, and this is actually a law on the books.
That's correct. Well, mandatory programs stay on the books, and they're reauthorized every few years. And so if you hear lawmakers say that a lot of the budget is on autopilot, that's what that means. It means that we have these mandatory programs, for example, Medicare or food stamps, and the federal budget automatically pays out money to beneficiaries of those programs, whereas this third of the budget, which is education and transportation, many other kinds of things, have to be appropriated each year.
Okay, and that changes every year at the discretion of lawmakers.
Exactly, although it tends not to change a whole lot year to year, although right now lawmakers are contemplating some deep cuts, which could make some changes for some time ahead.
Right, and this is one of the main reasons why you wrote this book, because a lot of people feel like they don't see their values in the budget, but in order to change the priorities, they need to understand how this process works.
That's exactly right. Without understanding how the process works or where their tax dollars are going right now, it's difficult or impossible for regular people to have an influence. But this process and the budget itself are changing all the time. They're changing slowly, but they're not set in stone. And so regular people, regular Americans, can have their say.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about discretionary, and we'll put this pie chart up on our website and our Facebook page, and you have this on your Facebook page. So again, discretionary spending is the portion of the budget that the president requests and Congress appropriates. So you've got this discretionary federal spending pie, $1.15 trillion, and we're talking about the coming fiscal year 2013. What really stands out for you in this pie?
Well, most people are shocked to know that about 57% of the discretionary budget funds the military. So you think about this pot of money, just the discretionary budget, that's the part that lawmakers are choosing each year. And in general, each year they choose about 57% of that money to go toward the military.
So $1.15 trillion, 57% to the military. And then just to throw out a couple other percentages, education 6%, housing 6%, veterans benefits 5%, health 5%. It's amazing. Science is just 3%. And then transportation 2%, food and agriculture a measly 1%.
That's right. And keep in mind, these are percentages of just the discretionary budget, which is only a third of the overall federal budget. So when you're saying just a couple percent for science, that's even smaller than it sounds.
Wow. Can you explain that?
Sure. Well, we're saying that it's 2 or 3% of the discretionary budget, and the discretionary budget is a third of overall federal spending. So it's really only about 1% of all federal spending that goes to science, and that's, you know, research that helps us cure diseases and so forth, and that's just about 1%.
We're speaking with Mattia Kramer. She's a senior research analyst with the National Priorities Project. And I'd like to give the number out early today because we are sort of doing a federal budget 101. Everything that you wanted to know about the budget, but maybe we're too embarrassed to ask. The fact is, we talk about the budget like we know how it works, but so many of us do not understand the process. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about the federal budget? And then what do you think of this interesting poll? One poll asked 1,400 Americans if they had ever used a government program. 57% said they hadn't. But the same respondents were asked if they used any of 21 different programs like home mortgage, interest deductions, unemployment benefits. 94% said they had used at least one. So what explains this confusion? People don't think that they're involved with the federal government, yet 94% are on a regular basis. So how does the federal budget affect your life, and what do you want to know about the process? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Now, I understand that from 96 to 2002, the White House actually released its Citizens Guide to the federal budget, but that's not around anymore. Is that right?
That's correct. George W. Bush, in the first year that his administration was putting out a budget, that was 2002, he terminated that program, which was called A Citizen's Guide to the Federal Budget, and was intended to explain federal spending for regular people. He did not ever resume that program during his administration, and President Obama also has not resumed the practice. And so our team at National Priorities Project decided to put out a book instead, and it's A People's Guide to the Federal Budget.
And why did George W. Bush stop putting this guide out?
You know, we don't know the answer to that. We can speculate. I think it's safe to say he didn't think that it was a priority for his administration.
And then President Obama, did he talk about bringing this back?
I think he's never talked about it. He did put out a tax receipt this year for the first time to show where folks' federal income taxes went. So that was certainly a step in the right direction. But they've not resumed the practice either.
And so it just started in 1996. And before then, we never had anything like a Citizen's Guide to the Federal Budget?
No resource like this, no.
Wow. So, well, what's interesting, though, is you do go into the history of the federal budget. And when you were doing this research, what really stood out for you and what's really changed since we started having a federal budget?
Yeah, one thing that stood out with me is that there's no prescribed process for putting together a federal budget. We can't look to the Constitution for this. That's something that Americans often like to do. Mm-hmm. There's no prescription for how we should do it. And for that reason, it's been an ever-changing process. And it changes based on what's going on in Washington. Sometimes lawmakers feel that the president has too much power. Sometimes the president feels that Congress has too much power. And so there's this back and forth. And because of that, different laws and parts of the process change.
And what really struck you about just how it's changed in terms of the dialogue and just the heated debate around the budget?
Well, right now is a time of particular contention. Folks are, there's, of course, we know that the partisan disagreement is bad right now, and so that is discouraging. But when you take a longer view, as we did writing the history chapter, I also see ways that things can change because laws change about how we put the federal budget together, and the engagement of citizens can also change. For example, in 2009, a group of citizens got together and they called themselves the Tea Party. Now, we may disagree with their political views, or we may love their political views, but regardless, they changed what's been happening in Washington since then, and other groups of Americans have that opportunity too.
You write that the Treasury Department, for example, was convened in 1789, and the first major piece of legislation regarding the budget process was the Budget and Accounting Act of 1921, which was enacted to improve federal financial management after World War I. A lot of the changes you see came about during wartime.
Oh, that's absolutely true. Big changes during wartime because federal spending has increased, hugely during wartime. That's World War I, especially World War II. And we know, of course, that federal spending increased over during wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so that created new needs in Washington about how to manage finances. And exactly as you say, with that Accounting Act in 1921.
And what about in terms of the pie, the 57% discretionary spending? A lot of people look to military spending. That usually is what gets the most attention when we talk about the budget. How has that really changed over the last decade?
Oh, the last decade has brought some big changes for military spending. So since 2001, what's called the Department of Defense base budget, so that doesn't include war spending, that nearly doubled in the space of a decade. So we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it opened up what former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates called a gusher of military spending. And so over that decade, it expanded greatly, and now it's sort of plateaued. and the Department of Defense now faces about a 2.5% cut to that base budget for the coming fiscal year.
And what do you think, because the military budget gets a lot of attention, what do you think people need to know about it, about just how it operates and maybe some myths surrounding the military budget?
Sure. Well, folks often think that we can't cut a penny from military spending because it will endanger national security. And national security is absolutely an important priority for many people. But there are lots of costly and obsolete weapons programs that military experts across the board have recommended sunsetting, and for various reasons in our Washington bureaucracy, they remain in place. And so there are ways of reducing military spending without sacrificing national security. That's an important thing to understand. Another interesting thing in terms of myths, it's surprising to find out that the Department of Defense is unable to pass an audit. So when you file your taxes in April and you tremble with fear at the thought of the IRS knocking on your door, well, the Department of Defense has for years now been unable to pass an audit and to account for where it's spending our tax dollars. And so many people think that that's a call for us now to rein in defense spending and to make some changes there.
Are many politicians calling for an audit?
Some do, and in some cases it's considered a quixotic claim and that the Department of Defense should be allowed to spend its money however it sees fit without the same kind of transparency that other agencies are held to.
And in terms of the process and the debate surrounding the budget, what really strikes you about the differences between how the military budget is dealt with versus something like, Social Security?
Well, actually, those two have some similarities because they're both considered to be political sort of holy grails. Like, you don't, it's unpopular to talk about cutting Social Security for obvious reasons. And for lots of reasons, it's often unpopular to talk about changing the military budget. But that may be changing now as folks realize that with deficits as large as they are now and many people calling for deficit reduction for better or worse, that people are going to take a harder look at the military budget.
We're speaking with Mattia Kramer. She's senior research analyst with the National Priorities Project, a nonprofit that aims to make the complex federal budget transparent and accessible. And she co-wrote the new book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about this process, just how the money is distributed, how these decisions are made? What questions do you have about this overall process? We're all affected by the budget. We talk about it like we understand it, but a lot of citizens have no idea how it works. A lot of citizens don't even realize how they're affected by the budget. So how are you affected by it? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. When we do shows about how the government spends money, we often hear from so many of you who say, this does not mirror my values at all. So how do you think, what can we do to really change the priorities? Again, when we look at discretionary spending, which changes not so much, but does change. We're talking military 57%, science 3%, transportation 2%, education 6%. What will it take, do you think, to change those percentages? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So we talked about discretionary spending. What about mandatory spending? We briefly touched on this, but it refers to the money that is spent based on existing laws that govern particular programs, things like Social Security, Medicare, food stamps.
Yeah, so an easy example of mandatory spending that most folks can relate to, we know about the Medicare program, which most of our senior citizens rely on for health care. So I know that when I turn 65, or I believe that when I turn 65, Medicare will provide health insurance for me. And I don't have to guess whether or not I'll be eligible for it. Because I'll turn 65, I will become eligible for Medicare. And then the federal government will pay out those health care benefits for me. So if we think about mandatory spending in those terms, those things that we can rely on, Medicare, Social Security, food stamps is another big one, that's what constitutes mandatory spending, which is nearly two-thirds of our federal budget.
And so you report that in 2011, the government spent $743 billion for all military programs versus $756 billion on Social Security.
That's right. So those are two of our biggest ticket items, Social Security and military, and certainly programs that many Americans put their support behind.
Well, we've got a related question on this, specifically about entitlements and how they got that name. Let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I was wondering if the guests could parse out the actually legal definition of what it really means to be an entitlement, because I'm under the impression that that is mandatory and not discretionary, and it has a lot of misnomers that go along with it, thinking that you're a spoiled brat and you're entitled to it. And I think it's a legal definition that makes it mandatory and it's not discretionary, like Social Security and Medicare, but I wanted to flesh out where the entitlement concept came from and how that parses out definition-wise.
Okay, thank you, Ruth Ann.
Thank you so much. That's such a great question. So you're absolutely right. It is a question of an actual legal definition. Mandatory spending arises from legislation that's passed into law that authorizes the federal government to pay out benefits based on the eligibility rules of a program. Now, that may sound like a lot of jargon, but it just means that if you turn 65, then you're necessarily eligible for Medicare, and the federal government must pay out those benefits for you. And so that is called often an entitlement program, and it does stem from that part of the law that says the federal government must pay out those benefits. And that's separate from discretionary spending, which must be have a special law passed for it in the appropriations process each year. And that keeps mandatory and discretionary spending as the separate and legally separate pools.
And when did we start using the word entitlement for these programs?
You know, I'm not sure how long the word entitlement has been in play, but it's certainly taken on negative overtones of late. And some people prefer the word earned benefit, which indicates, especially in the cases of Medicare and Social Security, that those are programs that you've paid into. And indeed, everybody who earns a paycheck in this country, regardless of income level, pays payroll taxes, which fund the Social Security and Medicare programs. So some people think of them as earned benefit programs. You've paid into them during your working life, and then you receive benefits to which you are entitled whenever you qualify.
All right. Well, thank you again, Ruth Ann. That was an important question about entitlements. We have a web comment from RIA who says, older data, but I liked this way of viewing my tax dollars. Where did my tax dollar? I'll have to click on this link to get the full URL. I want to be able to view where my tax dollars are spent when we are going to be able to influence this directly. Vote real time via the web on where we want our money spent. And I know that the National Priorities Project has a number of these calculators where you can type in, for example, your city to find out where your tax dollars are going at the city, state, and federal level.
Yeah, that's right. We have a tax receipt. So our website is nationalpriorities.org. Folks can click on interactive data and your tax receipt. And you can put in how much you paid in federal income taxes and see exactly how much you personally paid toward all the major federal programs and areas of government. For a sort of broad stroke, I can tell you off the top of my head that 27 cents of every federal income tax dollar funds the military, and about 2.5 cents of every federal income tax dollar funds education. And so when we see polls about how people would like their tax dollars to be spent, it's often those two categories that get the most attention. People say they'd prefer a bit less to go toward the military and more to go toward education.
And that website is wheredidmytaxdollarsgo.com. And we are talking today about the budget, the federal budget, the process, how it works. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. How does the federal budget affect you and your community? What changes would you like to see? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
Hello, this is Jack Feeney of Your Legal Rights. If you're facing surgery, please join me this Wednesday evening at 7 for a discussion on how to prevent a hospital-acquired infection and thus avoid having to bring a medical malpractice lawsuit against the hospital. My guest will be Dr. Marianne McGuckin, an expert in infectious disease prevention and author of an excellent new consumer book about how to have a safe hospital surgical experience. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 on Your Legal Rights here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. We are also improving our Facebook page, so you can like Your Call on Facebook. And tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with David Kirby about his new book, Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in Captivity. Do you think orcas should be held in captivity? There is a lot of new, there's actually a legal case right now surrounding the killing of a well-known trainer, Dawn Branchot. She was killed in 2010 by a captive 20,000-pound orca. Her death may lead to significant changes at marine mammal parks. So where do you stand on this very important issue? We'll be talking about that tomorrow. Oh, we also greatly improved our newsletter, and you can find more information about that at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the federal budget. President Obama announced that the U.S. government is planning to spend almost $4 trillion in 2013. Those are your tax dollars. More than 80% of the budget comes from your tax dollars. And we often talk about the federal budget like we understand the process. It gets so much scrutiny. But do we really know how the process works? Not according to studies, because a lot of people say, I'm not affected by the federal budget, yet they interact with about 97% of them interact with the federal budget on a daily basis. So how do you interact with the federal budget? What do you want to know about the process? What questions do you have? And if you disagree with how this money is actually spent, what do you think it'll take to change the process? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Mattia Kramer, Senior Research Analyst with the National Priorities Project. She co-wrote the book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. And let's hear next from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. I hope there's not going to be too much feedback here.
No, you're fine.
Okay. The question that I have is due to the inability of the committees that were meeting with regard to cuts to the federal budget in the last year or two, there's going to be a mandatory cuts, I think, come January of 2013, they're going to be dramatic. They're going to cut across the board. The defense will be cut, but there are going to be significant cuts to Medicare and other programs. So I'd like to hear your guest, if she's got information about this, to address this, because I don't think many people are paying attention to this. And when this happens come the end of the year, I think people are going to be really surprised about what's going to happen.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. That's a great question. It's very timely. These cuts are the result of the failure of the super committee last fall, which we've heard a lot about last October, November. The super committee was supposed to come up with a comprehensive deficit reduction plan to be phased in over a decade, and that committee failed to do so, as Greg pointed out. And because of that, the Budget Control Act passed last August says that automatic across-the-board spending cuts will go into effect beginning in January of 2013. Those cuts are scheduled to cut $55 billion from defense spending and $55 billion or thereabouts from non-defense spending. The mandatory programs, however, like Medicare, will actually not be affected, or in general will not be affected except for some small changes. So this largely affects the military and discretionary programs, from health and science research to education to transportation and so forth. So these cuts potentially could have a substantial effect on federal spending, as our caller pointed out. However, many people think that lawmakers will pass a deal prior to January of 2013 to prevent those cuts from taking place. Mm. this is something, the cuts are included in something that's being talked about as the fiscal cliff. You might have heard this term in the news. It refers to a host of spending cuts as well as tax increases that are all scheduled to take effect in January of 2013. And while some of these parts of this fiscal cliff might be good things, because we might want ultimately to cut some money from certain programs or to raise certain tax rates, a lot of people are concerned about having all of this happen all at once when our economy is still weak. And so folks think that lawmakers one way or another will pass a deal to prevent these cuts from taking place, or at least to delay them until the economy is stronger.
And what is the time frame for this? How can people raise their voices on this issue?
Well, the election is a great opportunity because we've got lawmakers from the House and the Senate and candidates for president who are all talking about what they want to do for us, for this country, come after 2013 when the elections have come and gone. And so this is a great opportunity for Americans to weigh in about whether or not we believe small domestic programs like education should be cut, or whether or not we believe that big cuts should be taken to the military. And this is a moment for us to weigh in and to listen to what candidates for office are saying. And many economists say that the wisest course would be not to undertake big spending cuts or spending cuts at all until the economy is stronger. And so this is an area in which Americans have an opportunity to weigh in, listening to candidates and contacting their current representatives in Congress.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Greg. And let's hear next from William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Thank you very much. I was curious about whether if a member of the armed forces is injured in battle or injured while he's in the armed forces and perhaps has to be in a veterans hospital, well, maybe even for the whole rest of his life or her life. Does that count in the military budget?
William, thank you. That's a great question. No, it doesn't. The veterans benefits are a separate issue from military funding, and most veterans benefits or the kind of benefits that you're referring to actually would go under mandatory spending. So that's something that we were just mentioning a bit earlier in the program, which means that veterans would be entitled to certain benefits such as health care or pensions after undergoing such an injury as you described. So the military budget, if it were cut, would not affect those kinds of veterans benefits that are often considered pretty crucial and often also talked about as not being significant enough given the sacrifice that veterans have made.
And when you look again at the discretionary federal spending pie, 57% military and just 5% for veterans benefits.
That's right. It's a much smaller budget than is the military.
And then, okay, so say after you look at that 57% for the military, how do you drill down at that point? Because there's a great website called militaryindustrialcomplex.com, and it takes a look at military contracts that are given out on a regular basis. And they report that just yesterday, almost $4 million in contracts were given out. Actually, is this billion? It's $4 billion, not $4 million. Isn't that? Yeah, it's $4 billion. Okay, given out just yesterday. This was down 37% from the day before. So can you kind of, how does that process work? Because you visualize it and you just think that there are checks being written on a regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, that's not far off. Unlike the appropriations process that we hear about in the news, where lawmakers are deciding how much money will go to defense and how much money will go to education, et cetera, the checks that you're talking about are doled out once the Department of Defense has received its budget, which, as you said, is many hundreds of billions, right? We said north of $600 billion in this year. The Department of Defense officials will then buy out from contractors, but that's not a process that has the kind of oversight that we get from the appropriations process. So there's very little sunlight into that, how contracts are chosen. And for that reason, many people believe it's an area that we need absolutely more scrutiny, since so many, and you said $4 billion of contracts yesterday, that was not a number I'd heard. But people say we need more scrutiny in that precise area.
I mean, it's amazing to look at this. $4 billion in one day. The day before, it was $6.2 billion.
And this is precisely why folks say that, given the hundreds of billions of our tax dollars that go into the military each year, that we ought to be able to know precisely where those dollars are going. And as we said, the Department of Defense is unable to pass an audit. That is, it can't tell us where all of those pennies are going.
Incredible. Well, this website is fairly in-depth, where it takes a look at where these contracts go, which companies receive these contracts, and what they're for. And on this issue, we have an email from Celine in Capitola who says, how is it possible that the military cannot pass an audit? Is there not a legal requirement that every department of government be able to itemize its spending within the defense budget? Are there separate breakouts for clandestine operations, for intelligence gathering, for example?
Yes and yes. So there is a requirement that the Department of Defense, that government agencies be allowed to pass audits. The Department of Defense enjoys a waiver from that year after year. And there is also money set aside for clandestine operations that we do not know, that we are not meant to know about for national security reasons.
All right. Well, thank you, Celine. Another great question. And we'll put this website, militaryindustrialcomplex.com, on our website, yourcallradio.org, right after the show. We have an email from Bill. He wants to read your book, and he's wondering if it'll be available as on the Kindle.
Yes, it absolutely will. The ebook version is coming out soon. It's not out yet, though, so stay tuned for it. Again, it's A People's Guide to the Federal Budget is our book, and it's certainly available now on Amazon. The paper copy and the ebook, the Kindle version, will be available soon. So thank you, Bill.
And available in your independent bookstore?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. And we're speaking with Mattia Kramer. She's senior research analyst with the National Priorities Project, and she co-wrote this book. The goal is to really give citizens the tools we all need to figure out how this process works, and then figure out how we can make changes if we think that the federal budget's priorities need to change. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about the federal budget and this process? How does it affect you? And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Bill in Berkeley. He says, I'm aware that over the last 40 years, the percentage of the California state budget provided by business and corporate taxes has fallen sharply. Is there a similar trend in where the federal revenue comes from?
Sure. Tax revenues across the board have fallen because of the recession, and that's led to state budget crises. Certainly, California is an apt example of that. But federal revenue has also declined, and so the federal government actually has increased its payouts to states for all sorts of programs, from teachers to firefighters, and that money often keeps states afloat, accounting for often a third of state budgets. So the federal government is a huge player in state budgets. And we don't often think about that when we think of federal programs. We sort of think of this money going off into a black hole. But the federal government sends money to the states, and that money is spent in state capitals and handed out to localities, small towns and communities. And so that's how the federal government, the federal budget affects us on a local basis. So it's a great point. The decline in state tax revenue has been in part made up by the federal government, and that has contributed to federal budget deficits.
And what else can you tell us about how that process works, about how the money flows to state and local governments? Because we often hear that, you know, if you slice the military budget, we'll have better health care or more services for the disabled or education. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, absolutely. So we face a trade-off, right, because every time we spend a dollar on the military, that's money that can't go to health care or to education. An important point in this regard is in an argument that people are making right now, given how weak the economy is, that that federal money would be better spent not sent to the Department of Defense, but instead sent to states for in education and health care, because those kinds of programs create more jobs per dollar than the military does. And so this could be a way of both bolstering domestic investment and also creating jobs.
All right. Well, thanks again for the question. And we have, let's go to our next caller, John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Good morning, Rose, and thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask your panel member, is there any substantial number of the House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate that's willing to curtail the growth of the military-industrial complex or just the growth of military expenditures in general. Is there any possibility of a group developing that could make some changes there?
So thank you, John. Thank you for that question. Actually, lawmakers in both parties have been loath to make cuts to military spending, and this is an area where public opinion does not match up with what's going on in Washington, and so certainly our mission in writing this book is to help people get more involved in how their tax dollars are spent, so this is a ripe opportunity for that. Most Americans think that there are opportunities to reduce military spending, at least to phase out some obsolete weapons programs that date from the Cold War era. And lawmakers have been hesitant to do that, sometimes for political reasons. We can speculate about whether political donations play a role. We can't know that definitively. But lawmakers have not, by and large, undertaken those kinds of cuts that you're talking about.
It's incredible. You've got a piece up at Tom Dispatch called Four Spending Myths That Could Wreck Our World. And Tom Dispatch points out that, for example, the F-35... that the price tag has just quadrupled over the last 10 years. The total cost for 2,457 of these F-35s is now at almost $400 billion. This is a jump of 75% over the original price tag of $226 billion. And yet there's hardly any scrutiny of this.
Yeah, that's considered the most costly weapons program ever to exist. There's hardly any scrutiny. And in that same piece, Tom of Tom Dispatch points out that the U.S. taxpayer has paid $17,000 for an oil drip pan, which is just what it sounds like, an oil drip pan. And why should it have cost $17,000? That's something that we, as the taxpayer, deserve to know more about.
Mm. Well, and then you do talk about myths, and you're spending myth number one. Let's talk about this one, because this gets so much attention, and that is today's deficits have taken us to a historically unprecedented, economically catastrophic place. We are about to enter the apocalypse, according to so many talking heads, when you're talking about the deficit.
Yeah, and it's just not true. So we're not running deficits of historic proportions. The deficit a couple years ago, when we were battling the Great Recession with every tool in the toolbox, was substantially higher. And back in World War II, the deficit as a share of the U.S. economy was three times what we're running now, or more than three times that. And so we're not facing deficits of historically unprecedented proportions. And most importantly, cutting the deficit right now could really, really harm our economic recovery, which ought to be our top concern. We've got to get out of the economic hole that we're in right now, and then absolutely we should undertake substantial deficit reduction, because no, we don't want to borrow the kinds of money that we're borrowing right now, but we should be doing so, according to most economists, in order to get out of the recession.
And yet this myth sticks and is repeated over and over again.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons why we believe that this book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget, has an important life to live, because when we hear something often enough, we just tend to believe it, and we're not armed with information to hear these claims and then set them aside and say, no, that's just not true, and that's a red flag that I ought not to pay attention to, and that's one that we really should set aside right now.
Well, we've got just about 6 minutes left, so if you have any questions about the federal budget or comments about this process, how it works, why you should care about this, how can we get more people interested in this issue? Because it does affect all of our lives. We are talking about how almost $4 trillion is spent every year in the U.S. 80% of that money comes directly from us. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Another myth you write about is that government health insurance programs are more costly than private insurance.
Yeah, so this is something that we're battling right now since we've come up the Affordable Care Act decision by the Supreme Court has come and gone. Many people are under the impression that government health care is a bad idea because it's necessarily less efficient than private health care. And in many cases, the government is indeed less efficient than the private sector. But health care is an unusual case for many reasons. Economists refer to something wonky called market failures. And the federal government is able to bargain for better prices and more efficient health care mm-hmm. than private insurers have been able to do. And so this is an important point and holds promise for this country going forward, because one thing that's not a myth but is true is that health care costs are right now uncontained, and that is a pressing issue for lawmakers.
And they do that with the VA, for example.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For the VA, but also Medicare and Medicaid are examples of, have various examples of lower prices and greater efficiencies than the private sector has been able to achieve.
And speaking of health care, another myth is that the Health Care Act will bankrupt the government while levying the biggest tax in U.S. history.
And this is another one that's now being repeated enough where it's hard not to believe. The Affordable Care Act, also called Obamacare, is actually going to reduce budget deficits. That's based on budget projections by the Congressional Budget Office. And only around 1% of American households will actually pay that penalty for lacking health insurance. And so it's neither going to bankrupt our government nor us with this new tax. And on the contrary, Affordable Care Act sets up some really important cost-saving devices to help contain health care costs down the road, which is actually an important issue.
We have a question from a listener about abstaining on taxes. If you want to protest where this money goes, what are your thoughts about that, about just not paying taxes?
It's a question that I get occasionally. I would say that I certainly can't endorse it myself. I've known folks, in particular war resistors or people who don't believe that their tax dollars should go to the military, have stopped paying federal income taxes. And I understand, I think that kind of conscientious objection has a place. And there's all sorts of things, ways that we can voice our beliefs. That's organizing, taking to the streets, also contacting legislators, and not paying your taxes. Maybe one of those methods for some people.
And what about, we talked a little bit about the deficit. What about, you have a section here called Why Do We Borrow?
Yeah.
Can you just talk about that briefly?
Absolutely. It's an important thing, because many people think that we ought to just balance the federal budget. Why ever borrow? Shouldn't the federal government balance its budget the way any household does? And there's a lot of reasons why that's not the case, why the federal government is different from a household. One reason is, and it's very, very pertinent right now, in an economic downturn, we want the federal government to be able to spend more than it takes in, because tax revenues automatically decline because people are out of work, and also more people qualify for things like unemployment benefits. If the federal government had to always run a balanced budget, then it would have to cut unemployment benefits at the very time when many people would be losing their jobs. So we want the federal government to have the option to borrow, and it plays an important role in our economy and actually in the global economy. So that's something, that's information that most people don't have, and without that information, it's easy to say, well, the federal government ought to balance its budget just the way I do.
Right, because you often hear, why would we do this to the next generation? We've got about $47,000 in debt for every citizen, and our grandchildren are going to be left with the bill.
That's right, and so that's the reason why, when the economy is stronger, we ought not to run big budget deficits, because we'll pay interest on that, in addition to having to pay back the money that we borrow. So there's, of course, a case to be made to get borrowing under control when the economy is strong, and we also want our government to be able to borrow on our behalf when the economy isn't so good.
We have a question from David about taxes. And again, when we're talking about an almost $4 trillion budget, 80% of that money comes directly from taxpayers. His question is, what percentage does the top 1% pay of federal income tax? What percentage of the nation's incomes do they receive? And what percentage of the net wealth do they own? Do you have numbers on this?
Yeah, the number that I have actually combined is from Citizens for Tax Justice, a wonderful tax research organization. So the top 1% of taxpayers earn about 20% of all income in this country, and they end up paying around 20% of all federal, state, and local taxes. So that means that our tax system is just about proportional, meaning that if you pay, you earn X amount of all the income, you ought to pay X amount of the taxes. So you sometimes hear folks saying that the wealthiest pay far too much of the taxes, and that's a matter of opinion. But the fact of the matter is that if you're in favor of a progressive tax system in which wealthy folks pay more of the taxes than their low-income counterparts, our system is not as progressive as one might think.
And Gar Alperovitz, an economist who's been on our show, spoke at the Green Party convention over the weekend and pointed out that the richest 400 people in the U.S. own more wealth than the bottom 150 million. It's kind of hard to create a visual of that. 400 people versus 150 million. And Stephen, we don't have time to take your call, but I'll ask your question. Stephen wanted to know, who is actually paying for our wars?
Well, we are, in one way or another, regular people. So some of our tax dollars go to pay those wars, and then the federal government borrows the difference. And that money, by and large, is also borrowed from Americans who invest in treasury bonds. And some of it gets financed by investors overseas. We hear, of course, that China buys our debt. China is just one of many countries that buy our debt. And so we all together pay for those wars, and the federal government will end up paying interest on the borrowed money down the road, and our tax dollars will fund that as well.
And if final thoughts, Barbara Ehrenreich in the Forward points out that this year the president, the entire House, and one-third of the Senate are up for re-election. With more budget cuts in the pipeline, the officials we elect in November will have the opportunity to completely reshape our country for years to come. What is the most effective way to raise your voice on these issues?
Well, contacting elected officials is priceless. We think that they don't listen or that we can't make a difference, but it's not true. Lawmakers' offices actually do keep track of constituent calls, and when there's overwhelming constituent support or support for a particular issue, then they hear that. So that's an important way. And the other way in this election year is to pay attention to what's going on, to know about what's going on, and to vote.
And again, the announcement came out already that fiscal 2013, which starts in October, is almost $4 trillion. Is this all a done deal at this point?
It's not. Our lawmakers have avoided putting together an actual federal budget, which would decide how all that money is going to be spent in 2013. And they'll probably put it off until after the election,
okay,
because they're afraid of making decisions beforehand.
Right. So you do have time now to continue raising your voice for fiscal year 2013.
Oh, boy, do you.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really did enjoy reading the book. I enjoyed the cartoons and all the graphics.
Great.
So thank you so much. Mattia Kramer is Senior Research Analyst with the National Priorities Project. She co-wrote the book, A People's Guide to the Federal Budget. Thanks, Mattia.
Thank you.
And thanks for your really great questions. You can find more information about this at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Should orcas be held in captivity? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with David Kirby about his new book, Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in Captivity. In 2010, a captive 12,000-pound orca killed the well-known trainer Don Branchot at SeaWorld Orlando. Her death may lead to significant changes at mammal parks. It also sparked a heated debate about whether the world's top predator should be held captive. Where do you stand? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.